Believing is seeing. I think a lot of us have heard the other way around, seeing is believing. But I think this actually describes very well what Jesus asks us to do. We need to believe so we can see. Some of you may remember in the Old Testament, the children of Israel, they're getting ready to go into the promised land. And they have the ark, they have everyone ready to go. And they're like, you know, okay, now what? And we'll step into the water, this muddy Jordan water, river water, and that's flooding, and that's everywhere. And they're okay, but you sure you don't want to open it first, and then we'll go through? No, get in the water first, and then you will see. They believed, and then the waters divided. And they were able to see the works, the power of God. And they stepped into the land. I think all of us have had experiences of having to step out in faith. I'm sure you can think of many things, many times in your life. As I think back, moving to a new place, getting a new job, being married, having kids. One of the things that happened to me in 1996 is I entered the MFT, Marriage and Family Therapy program at Friends University to start to train to be a marriage and family therapist, which is what I do today. And I got a lot of really new perspectives, and it was very helpful for me. And feel like I was maybe less blind than I was before, trying to see more clearly. And as I was a pastor before that, associate pastor, I would often try to talk with people and encourage them and so forth. And I always felt like I just knew enough to be dangerous, you know? And so I felt I need some more training. And, you know, I know the Bible, but I learned that there is a lot more I could learn. And that includes in what is in the Bible. And so one of the things that the program focused on is less what happens within an individual and the science behind that, which is a lot of the therapies that we see, it focuses mostly on what happens actually between individuals, the different patterns of interactions that people have, and the science behind that. And so that is what I ended up majoring in and going through the program with. While I was going through this time, I was really working hard to say, how do I integrate my faith with all this new information? It seems really good, and it seems right in a lot of ways, but does it square with God's word? And so it was a lot of work for me to kind of think about that. Some of the books that helped me a lot, some of you may have heard of John Townsend and Henry Cloud, and they wrote Boundaries books. They've written a number of books. But what I really enjoyed about reading those books is that they said, okay, yes, we have some psychology stuff here we're trying to encourage you to do, but here are the scriptures. Here are the Bible verses that we feel like we're going off of, that where we're kind of grabbing this. So one of the Bible verses I remembered quite distinctly as I read their works and listened to some of their tapes was John 1:14. And so here in the book of John, way at the beginning, we're in chapter 9 now, but way in chapter 1, there's this verse. And the Word, that's Jesus, became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. And one of the things they talked about and that I started to see that I needed to think more about is that Jesus came full of grace and truth. Sometimes we may focus on one or the other, but we need both. And as we look at the life of Jesus, as we look at our miracle today and in the book of John, as you look at his life, we see that this is what Jesus did when he interacted with people. He came to them with grace and truth together. So grace, what is that? Well, the Greek word for grace is charis, and it means grace or kindness or favor. Truth is aletheia, and that is, you know, is truth. But it's not just that word. It's spoken truth. It's also moral reality. It's divine truth. It's from God. And so these two, now you put together, holding grace and truth together. What is so awesome about this is that we can see the reality of a situation when we have the truth, don't we? We can see what's really happening, and that we need God for that. And then we can experience the kindness of God at the same time. You know, those two things together changes lives. And it's Jesus that brings that to us, to change us. And then we have an opportunity to bring grace and truth to others in the name of Jesus. So that is a little bit of kind of what we're going to look at today. So we are going to see three spiritual realities in this chapter. First of all, the miraculous spiritual sight by Jesus. Secondly, the spiritual blindness of the Jewish leaders. And lastly, new spiritual sight by the man born blind. So first of all, verses 1 through 12, miraculous spiritual sight by Jesus, one of these spiritual realities. And so we see, first of all, spiritual sight comes from the works of God. We see this in verses 1 through 4. As he passed by, he saw a man born blind at birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Now, that's a good question, right? I mean, what happened here, Jesus? You know, and of course, in that day, and maybe in our day sometimes today, we think, okay, there's a reason behind this, and it's probably sin, and so who messed up here? You know, whose fault is this? Who shall we blame? And maybe in some ways, right? Oh, not that helpful, right? But Jesus answered, it was not this man who sinned. Jesus isn't just going to say, oh, yeah, let's blame it all on him. Or his parents. Oh, okay. No, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. So there's a whole other thing. Get pulled back. It's not all about sin. We have sin. Sin's a reality. But God's up to something about redeeming us, about making things right for us because of our sin, right? And these are the works that he does. We must work the works of him who sent me. While it is day, night is coming when no one can work. And so we see that you know, that these works are very important. Now, what are these works? You know, it gives us a little bit of a clue here, but actually the book of John starts talking about this all the way back in John chapter 4. Jesus at the well with the woman from Samaria. And he, as you remember, he is talking to her and kind of, and she is converted and believes him, and she runs back. And the disciples come back and go, what's going on? Who are all these people who are coming and so forth? And we've got some food. Jesus, aren't you hungry? And he's like, not right now. He says, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. And so Jesus had something that sustained him that went beyond the physical food. He had this spiritual work that was happening, and he was so happy, he was so glad to do it, and he could see that this was making an impact, and that was his work. Then John 5, this happens again, 17 through 18, Jesus heals an invalid on the Sabbath and receives criticism for healing on the Sabbath and says, my Father is working until now, and I am working. And then we see in the next verse that this upset the Jewish leaders for a couple of reasons. One, Jesus was working on the Sabbath. You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath, right? It's supposed to be a day of rest. And two, he was making himself equal with God. He called God his Father. And then finally, we see this in chapter 6. Jesus feeds the 5,000. And he is asked, what must we do to be doing the works of God? Again, a really good question. And Jesus answers then in verse 29, this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. So there's this work, but yet in some ways, what's our part, right? Well, if you notice, it looks like Jesus does the work, doesn't he? They're the works of God, and Jesus does the works. Our job is to believe in Jesus, the one who is doing the works. We trust that Jesus will change the lives of us and other people around us. That is our job. If you've ever been involved in a ministry of some kind and you're trying to help people, sometimes people don't want help. Has that ever happened to you? It's happened to me, especially when at work. But anyway, I will say that that it's so freeing to be able to say, you know what? It's not my job to change them. It's not my job to do the work. My work now is to believe that Jesus will change them and to pray for them, to have faith, to step out and have conversations with them in grace and truth and see what Jesus will do. Amen. So we see that spiritual sight not only comes from the works of God, but we also see that spiritual sight comes from the light of the world. This is in verse 5. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world, says Jesus. So one of the things about John, also a characteristic that we have, if you notice as you read through the book, is that Jesus often makes self-identifying statements. I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. He does this often, right? In today's passage, I am the light of the world. And he does this because he's trying to help people understand who he is and who to believe in. So this statement today in verse 5, Jesus makes that statement, I'm the light of the world, but actually he made this already in a couple of the chapter before. John 8:12, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. And so you can see that Jesus is continuing to say the same things, to try to help people to see the light, right? And then we can even go back further to John chapter 3. Very, very soon after the famous John 3:16 passage, if you know that passage, that verse, verses 19 through 21 says, and this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and the people love the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. And so we see Jesus goes on to further define what is this light? What is happening with this light? And why is it so important? And it's important that because it exposes the things that that need to be changed. And we need to be close to Jesus in that. So we see that from the beginning of the book, even in chapter 1, John identifies Jesus as the light given to all of us so we can see the truth and we can receive his life-giving gift to be a part of the family of God. Part of overcoming spiritual blindness is being then near the light of Jesus so we can see, right? We need to sit right next to him. We need to get close to him. We need to be reading his word and praying and talking about him with other believers, trying to understand and receive his light. And then part of our ministry with others certainly is to share that light of Jesus with others. To know that, oh, I have light, I'm sitting here, come over here. Let's look at this light in the light of Jesus together. And I hope that is a helpful way to look at it, because we need to sit near Jesus and we need to help others when we help them sit near Jesus as well, Jesus in us. Well, spiritual sight not only comes from the works of God, the light of the world, but also miraculous spiritual sight comes from active faith. This is in verses 6 through 12, which we read before. Jesus seems like he's always seems to ask people to do something as a demonstration of their faith as we read the book of John. You know, there it's kind of like, okay, well, I think you have faith. I believe you have faith. We'll go show me your faith, right? And a lot of times, like I said, sometimes we have to take that first step and then we see, right? And so we see that earlier in John, the wedding of Cana, Jesus turns water to wine. So he tells them, fill the water jars, right? He asked them to do something, and they did. And then he says, okay, I'm going to turn this water into wine. Now taste it. Let's serve it. And they did. The invalid at the pool that we mentioned earlier from Bethsaida is asked to get up, take up your bed, and walk. So again, Jesus says, show me. And, you know, again, oh no, he picked up his bed and he's carrying it around. That's work. So he was going to get in trouble for this, but he knew he had to have faith. He had to believe if he really wanted to be healed. So here in chapter 9, Jesus has him go to the pool of Siloam to wash his eyes. And you think about it, well, he could have asked him to really walk anywhere to wash his eyes. I'm sure there were water nearby, right? And I'm sure he could have said, where's the nearest water? Just let me just wash my eyes and see if this is real or not, you know? But no, he realized, no, there was something important about trusting and obeying Jesus in this moment. And doing exactly what Jesus said was part of his faith. And so he did. And then he came back seeing. Another defining characteristic of John is the small amount of miracles compared to the other gospel writers. If you'll notice, and you read the book of John, there's actually only 7 miracles. That's a fun number, isn't it? 7? 7 miracles in the whole book. And, you know, you can't read Matthew, Mark, or Luke without, you know, going another verse and running into another miracle. You know, I mean, they're everywhere, right? I mean, I don't know how many. I mean, you can count them to yourself, but there are lots, right? And then, but here in the book of John, only 7. So I think that maybe is something we need to pay attention to. Our miracle today is one of the last of the miracles, miracle number 6. The last one, the 7th one, was when he raised Lazarus from the dead. Maybe you remember that. It doesn't seem random to me that the healing of a blind man should coincide with Jesus' statement, I am the light of the world. And so Jesus is constantly talking about, this is who I am, and this is why you should believe. So we've talked about active faith already today, and we'll say more about that in a little bit. We now move on to the next section, spiritual blindness of the Jewish leaders. So we see now in verses 13 through 17 that spiritual blindness comes from simplistic rule following. Let's look at that together. 13 through 17. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes, and I wash, and I see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. And then they had a division after that, because some said, well, what about the signs, right? And so keeping the Sabbath meant for those people, they had these rules, right? And you do not work on the Sabbath. Healing somehow fell under that. And so they're just keeping the rules, you know. Others said, well, what about these signs? And then they finally ask the man, so what about you? You can decide this between us, right? Well, I think he's a prophet. And the Pharisees are like, that's not what we wanted to hear. Wrong answer. Okay. And yet, you know, I think this calls us to think about what is our definition of sin? What really is it? In some ways, you could say, well, you know, sin is not following the rules. If you don't follow the rules, well, certainly it helps to follow rules. But is that all there is to it? Is it that simple? It doesn't seem that's what Jesus is saying here, is it? What if the sin definition is making anything else besides God what you worship into a god? what you focus your life on. If it's not God, then it's a sin, right? Sometimes called idolatry, right? Kind of get into that. But so reality is complex. God is so complex. We do not understand God, do we? We're so far underneath him. We have no idea. We have a few ideas because he told us, right? But there's so much we don't know that we cannot even comprehend. So it would follow also then if he created us as complex human beings, that the decisions of what is good, what is best to do, will also be complex. And it won't be easy just follow that rule. Again, nothing wrong with following rules. But is there more to it? There certainly was more to it in this situation, wasn't there? And Jesus says, you got to look at that. You're just following the rules. And guess what? Because you're just following these rules, you're actually making the rules into God. And then you're worshiping and focusing on that. And you got the wrong priorities. So it's relatively easy to follow rules for some people. It is much more complex and difficult to communicate with the God of the universe and submit to his all-knowing will. But that is what we're asked to do. So spiritual blindness is not only comes from simplistic rule following. Spiritual blindness also comes from abusing political power. In verses 18 through 23, we see the Jews, Pharisees and Jews, Jewish leaders, they're all kind of working on this together. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who received his sight and asked him, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? Then how does he now see?" His parents answered, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But how he now sees, we do not know, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age. Ask him." So we see that they threaten, that there is a threat that he will actually be put out of the synagogue. He will not be able to come to worship. He will not be able to come to fellowship with other people who believe in the Messiah and have faith in God. And so these are leaders abusing this political power. They are coercing him. They are threatening him. And they're not saying, "Well, you know, if that's what you want to believe, you know," they're saying, "You know, you're out of here, buddy." And the reason we're doing it is because this is the wrong answer. And this is a very simple situation. Either you believe this or you don't. And and we know better than you. And so how does he see? He gave the wrong answer. And this was really there in some ways, you could say, well, it's a spiritual point of view, but it's really much also a political point of view. The politics, they knew what was going to happen. They would run out of power if Jesus or anyone else kind of took over their leadership, right? There was money and there was power invested in all these things. And so it ended up being a political situation in many ways. One of the things I studied when I was in marriage and family therapy training was a couple who did couples work. John and Julie Gottman are their names. They're from Washington State. And they did a lot of marriage research. And they were able to find predictors of divorce and were able to kind of contribute and then say, okay, so how do we work against those predictors and what, you know, so we're aware about what those are so people can stay together. And so they actually had four things that they said, hey, these are four things that if you do, are doing in your marriage, then, the prediction of you getting divorced goes way up. And they called them the four horsemen of the apocalypse because it's just so devastating, right? So it was criticism, defensiveness, stonewalling, and lastly, contempt. Now, I don't going to take the time to go all through all four of these today, but I will say that the one they said it was the most highest predictor that couples would get a divorce is if they had contempt for each other. What does that mean? Well, you kind of have an idea, right? You just hate this other person, and you hate them so much, and you're so hurt or whatever it is that they've done to you, that you cannot think positively at all about them. You just can't do it. And so people then will have what they call negative attributions. That's a little technical term. I just threw that in there. But what it means is attributing negative meaning to positive acts from that other person. So you can have someone, oh, it was so nice. You know, they did the dishes for me. Oh, well, yeah, he must want something. Right? You know, again, you cannot just accept a gift and you cannot see it as positive. Oh, they're trying to manipulate me. I've done this before. Now, that doesn't mean that's not happening, right? But you see how, where do you go from there? How do you work on a relationship if you cannot see any positive in what this other person is doing? You know, how do you get out of that? How do you dig your way out of that? And so it makes sense. And in some ways, isn't that what the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders are doing right here? They have contempt for Jesus. Jesus does a miracle and heals a guy who is blind from birth. Nope, he's not from God. We can't say anything good about him. The blindness, right? The blindness. And so it's so important that we see that spiritual blindness comes from these negative situations like that and negative attributions. So spiritual blindness comes from some simplistic rule following, abusing political power, and also spiritual blindness comes from a lack of humility. And this is in verses 24 through 34. It's a fairly long passage, and I did read it earlier. Let me just make a few statements about it. The Jewish leaders say, give glory to God. You know, why can't you just give glory to God? Why do you have to give glory to Jesus about this? Well, he's the one who healed me, you know. And it's just, again, they come through this and they definitely have, we know better than you. We know better than you. This pride that comes in there. And then they are like, well, go over your story again. Let's hear it one more time so we can try to catch you in a discrepancy. And just then prove you're wrong, right? They're just trying to set them up. And we see this happening in the story here. And then he says, we are disciples of Moses. We keep his rules better than you. Now, they didn't say it that way, but that's what they meant, right? And then finally, we are above you since you were born in utter sin. Oh, now we're going back to what the disciples thought earlier, right? So was it this man's fault that he was born blind? He must have been born in utter sin, right? Again, this is this way of thinking. And Jesus says, no, that's not how it works. People decide that they will sin and they will disobey and they will go a different direction and accept other ways of salvation than myself. And that's what these guys were doing, the Jews, the Jewish leaders. You don't teach us, we teach you. You are beneath us, right? And so we see that they really shame him at that point. They say, we are up here and you are down here, right? And what it seems that the Bible teaches is that's not how it works with people, right? Now, God is up here and we are down here, right? But people, all of us, we're right here, just the same place. We're all unique. We all have strengths. We all have weaknesses. But no one is worth more than the other. We are all worth so much to God. But if you put yourself above someone else, that you are more valuable, then God says, no, That is not right. Because guess what? There are people in this world who will hear that and go, you're right, you're right, I'm terrible. And they will just go along. Luckily for us, we get to see an example of the blind man, the man born blind, who did not do that. Did you see how he stood up for himself? Stood up for Jesus? And he said, no, you're not going to put, I'm right here. And they said, okay, then we're going to put you out. You're out of here. And he was willing to do that because he said, no, this is not right, and I'm following Jesus. So the last section is new spiritual sight by the man born blind. And so we see this in the last few verses, 35 through 41. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. And so we see, first of all, that new spiritual sight comes from faith and worship. I believe. And he worshiped him. It's so important that to have new spiritual sight in our own lives, that we are awed by God, that we take in who he is, that we worship him, that we're submissive to God, and he calls him Lord, doesn't he? New spiritual sight comes from faith and worship. It also, new spiritual sight comes from acceptance of our own blindness and need of healing. I heard of this illustration the other day of, you know, as you grow older, you start to look back and think, why did I say that? Why did I do that back then? I was just so young. I just was so, I guess I didn't know better, right? I couldn't see. I in some ways I was blind, right? There's things I just didn't see, didn't understand. And so, you know, you have a 15-year-old self to a 12-year-old self. Oh no, I can't believe, I was 12 and I did that, and I embarrassed myself when I said that, and you know, and then you could have a 40-year-old say that to a 21-year-old self, right? Oh wow, yeah, got a lot more under my belt now with that experience. Oh boy, if I was 21, I'd probably do this and this different. I was blind back then; I couldn't even see what I was really needing to do. And then you have a 130-year-old saying to an 85-year-old self, oh, I can't believe it. But you see, you're right, because there's always going to be differences. There's always going to be these changes. So the point is, no matter where we are blind. We are blind, wherever we are, whatever age we are. And that's what Jesus is saying. You say we see, so you're blind. When you say you're blind, that means you can actually see now. What a paradox, right? But it's so true. In conclusion, we have seen miraculous spiritual sight by Jesus, spiritual blindness of the Jewish leaders, and new spiritual sight by the man born blind. As I mentioned before, Jesus is full of grace and truth. And you can see how Jesus brings grace and truth to bear. In this particular miracle, Jesus tells the truth about who he is. He's the light of the world. And that later on in the passage we just read, he came to judge, to demonstrate that those who say they can see are actually blind, and that those who say they're blind need to trust God for sight, and they're the ones that can see. So Jesus comes with the truth, and he judges. Sometimes we think, oh, well, the judgment's till later. Oh, no, he started. Also, Jesus brings grace, not only healing the man born blind, but coming back to him to allow him to see with his physical eyes what he saw with his spiritual eyes already. Personally, I was raised and in my home as with parents who I love and who did such a great job in so many ways. One of the things that they struggled with a bit is the role of truth and grace were not kind of pulled together. There was one of the parents was truth and the other parent was grace. and so I've tended to come to situations kind of with one or the other. And then, like, oh yeah, I need to drag this other one in here, you know, and sometimes it's too late. But so now that explains why I might make mistakes in how I treat others, but it does not excuse me from how I treat others. I have to learn. I have to receive the grace and truth that God is trying to tell me to be changed. And then I can treat others in the same ways. So finally, what is Jesus trying to teach you about what you are not seeing today? What is Jesus trying to teach you about how to accept his grace and his truth today? We cannot heal ourselves. We must believe so we can see.